Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 10th, 2026. We are awaiting quorum, so we cannot do minutes. But what we're going to do is show some flexibility. Representative Quam, since you're a member of the committee, we're going to have you. And then since we're laying your bill over, that will be something that we can work with. Once that happens, we will get to Chair Scott whenever we get quorum established. And we'll do minutes and all those fun things. And Representative Quam, since you're a member of the committee, I'll let you move your own bill and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would move House File 3672.
And we are laying it over. Your bill is before the committee. Please proceed.
Well, basically, for many years, I've been on a legislative audit commission of where we see during the audits what agencies aren't doing quite to standard or should be doing to do a better job. And frankly, with all of the increased focus on audits, I talked with Ann Rest, who's the chair of the Legislative Audit Commission, and said, we need to have the auditor sit with the reviser and do a lot of clarification so that it's less likely people in different agencies are going to say, oh, we misunderstood what we were supposed to do. Correct things that are missing, such as you can't go to work for a person you've given a grant to days after you gave them $700,000, which has come up in the audit. So everything in this bill is from past audits in order to ensure that our agencies are doing the full and appropriate activity that they're supposed to be doing. So if there are specific questions, the auditor is here, because my point with Senator Rest was we have the auditor work directly with. And for years, there have been comments made by members of the commission that we as a legislature need to tighten up these rules that cause problems. So I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Is there anybody that would like to testify on the bill? I see someone coming forward. Once you get there, if you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Nash, Chair Claiborne, and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Administration, and I'm here to make some brief remarks on this bill, House File 3672. Sections 5 through 11 of the bill amend provisions of Chapter 16B, which address grants management practices administered by the Department of Administration through its Office of Grants Management. These changes enhance the authorities and duties of the office. It bolsters reporting requirements. It strengthens agency monitoring responsibilities. It increases training mandates, and it lays out limitations to avoid conflicts of interest. So these are all items that we support and in some cases already require through policy or procedure. We appreciate the OLA bringing these items forward, as well as appreciate the ongoing collaboration that has been developed between the OLA and the Office of Grants Management. The one section that I do want to call out that has raised some concerns is Section 3 of the bill related to payment oversight. This adds a section in 16A which makes all appropriations, allocations, payments, or other transfers of money from the state to an entity that is not a state agency or political subdivision subject to all the grants management requirements contained in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 16B. We believe the language as it's currently written covers a much larger scope than what is intended, resulting in a large fiscal impact and conflicting regulatory overlap. I'm happy to say more about our concerns in greater detail if there are questions, But in the interest of time, I'll just say that we are committed to working with the author and the OLA to go over the details of this particular section to help develop language that aligns with the intended protections. And in fact, we do have a meeting scheduled with Auditor Randall later on this week to do so. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Chair Cleburne, are you asking to be recognized?
If I could, please, Hayes. Ms. Hayes, could you please, one, talk about grants management and grants as contracts? That's one piece. And then a second, could you talk about 16B and 16C, if you don't mind? Thank you.
Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, Chair Cleburne, could you please repeat that first part? Talk more about...
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you so much, Chair Nash. So over the interim, you know that I worked with a large working group, and we talked about individuals referring to grants, right? But grants, generally speaking, are a type of contract, right? They aren't just dollars given out for entities to do whatever they want. There's a requirement that services or something is in return for that consideration. So one, I would like you to just kind of talk about how grants are reimbursements, generally speaking. And then two, I have concern about the conflicts maybe that exist in this bill between Section 16B and 16C, if you could discuss those.
Ms. Hayes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cleburne, you're correct. Grants, you know, there are distinct types of ways that the state expends its funds. Two in particular that I'm most familiar with are the practice of issuing grants, and the other is through procurement. Grants are covered in provisions of Chapter 16B, and as you mentioned, are typically reimbursement-based. There needs to be a legislative legislative authority to issue the grant, and it's generally given to a third party to where the impact goes outward to third parties. Procurement contracts, by contrast, are more inward-facing. They are contracts that the state agencies enter into through authorities in Chapter 16C for services and commodities and other construction, for example, that the state requires. The differences are important, I think, and a lot of the focus, particularly with the fraud issues, are on another type of payment that aren't covered by Chapter 16C or 16B. In this particular situation, the overlap here in that Section 3 is that it could capture procurement, for example, and it's seeking to apply the provisions of Chapter 16B to things like procurement payments. And so that's kind of the regulatory overlap that I mentioned that we want to help revise the language with the auditor to clarify.
Chair Cleburne, follow up or?
No, I just want to thank Representative Quam. I think the intent of the bill is good, right? And I think it opens up further discussion, and I appreciate the fact that administration, you representative, and the OLA are willing to continue to work on this, and I'm glad we're laying it over so that we have time to get that work done. So thank you very much.
Ms. Hayes, thank you very much. Representative Quam, any further?
Basically, I was contacted last week, and my direction was for them to directly work with the auditor on the language, because I want something that is not the, you know, let's get in front of cameras and do our talking points, but something that was just focused on the actual details. And that's why they're connecting with the auditor, because frankly, with years of experience and seeing what has been done and not done, I think that expertise is needed. And so I will continue to work on this and thank the committee for the hearing.
Chair Quam, thank you. And with that, House File 3672 is laid over. Next, we will take a slight move backwards before we have Chair Scott. You can come on up to the testifier, but we're going to move a series of minutes from previous meetings, so I'll just go through this in the hope of expediency. The chair moves the minutes from February 24th, 2026. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Then we will move. I will move the approval of the minutes from March 3rd, 2026. Any questions? That many? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. The chair will then move March 5th, 2026 minutes. Any questions? Once, twice? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those minutes are approved. That's the most amount of minutes we've ever approved in one fell swoop. That's great.
See what we can do together?
We can. All right, Chair Scott, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 1234 before the committee. Chair Scott, to your bill. And I believe you have a DE1.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Chair moves the DE1. Questions? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? The DE is engrossed. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cleavorn. Members, thank you for the hearing on House File 1234. It's a little bit like Sesame Street in the morning here in State Gov. This is called the Payment Transparency Act. This is an important bill for Minnesota's construction industry. It increases transparency on public construction projects, ensures small businesses can submit timely invoices for their work, and helps subcontractors use existing legal remedies to get paid faster. Before we go to testifiers, I want to briefly discuss all the efforts that have gone into this bill. House File 1234 has broad bipartisan support, and I want to thank my co-authors, Representatives Feist, Hollins, Howard, Myers, Sexton, Meekland. And the bill also has bipartisan support in the Senate. 16 trade associations support this bill, and that list is included in your packet. Over the past year, we have held three large stakeholder meetings with 20 to 30 participants representing public owners, contractors, and industry groups at every meeting. We have had many additional conversations and many emails exchanged. The amendment before you reflects significant negotiation and compromise. The bill has changed substantially since introduction, and subcontractors have made meaningful concessions to make compliance workable for public owners and contractors. At this point, most of the stakeholders are supporters or neutral. With the amendment today, the Department of Admin, the Department of Transportation, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and the Department of Natural Resources are neutral on the bill. The basis of the DE amendment came from the public owners, and it was shared that this was their no-cost proposal. That said, this identical amendment was adopted in the other body last week, and a fiscal note has been requested. So with that, what does this bill do? It does two things. First, it establishes a clear process for subcontractors to request payment information from public owners. Second, it clarifies that subcontractors may submit invoices for their work without being delayed or prohibited by administrative barriers that slow down payment. Finally, I would like to let the committee know, after many rounds of negotiation, a limited number of stakeholders have requested additional changes. We will continue our work to try and address everything that we can, but many very significant concessions have already been made. With that, I have two testifiers here to share their perspectives: Heather Hoffman, a subcontractor, and Blake Nelson, a construction attorney.
The testifiers would come forward, and as they are coming forward, Chair Cleavorn has a question.
Mr. Chair, we moved the bill as amended before the committee, but I just want to make sure the motion is to move the bill to labor with a return to state government at a later date. Is that correct?
Chair Scott.
Chair Cleavorn, Chair Nash, yes. We're happy to bring it back here.
Thank you very much.
You're well. So Chair Scott, who do you prefer goes first? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair and committee members, my name is Heather Hoffman, and I represent Commercial Drywall Incorporated, a Minnesota commercial subcontractor. Commercial was founded in 1993 by my father, who I worked alongside most of my career until he passed away in 2020. I am now a second-generation leading CDI as a certified targeted small business serving Minnesota for over 33 years. In our busy seasons, we typically employ between 65 and 85 Minnesota construction professionals. We take great pride in the work we do on public construction projects in Minnesota, and we value the companies that work alongside us and the public owners that we serve. To work on a public job requires significant administrative responsibilities and long payment terms. We secure insurance and bonds, pay prevailing wage or higher. As an example, we might provide employee background checks, detailed wage reports, workforce utilization reports, lien waivers, bond claim waivers, and other required documents each month to public owners. In addition to these obligations, we often wait many months or years to be paid in full for our work. House File 1234 proposes a straightforward solution: greater transparency about payments, the right to submit a timely invoice for work we have performed. These small changes will allow us to plan our cash flow and know when we should be getting paid. To provide an example, on a fire station project in Minnesota, not to be named, Commercial Drywall completed our work on April 14th of 2025. There are no defects or claims on our work. Our work has been accepted as complete. Despite completing our contract in April of 25, we have not yet been paid in full. I expect at a minimum, it will be at least 3 more months before we will see our final payment. Truthfully, I'm not sharing this example to put anyone on the spot. I'm sharing this example because slow payment like this is commonplace in the industry, and something must give if we want small businesses to succeed. The cost of capital is real. Late payments erode profits. Markup on public work is typically stipulated at 10% by contract. With interest rates on lines of credit 6% and higher, it does not take long to erase margin. This bill doesn't guarantee we get paid for the invoice we submit, but at least we will be able to submit it. And being able to submit a timely invoice is a big deal and will do a lot of good for businesses like mine. Thank you very much, Chair Scott, for carrying this bill and for the committee's support.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Just a quick question for you. How much are you owed on that project, just so members can have an understanding of the problem at scale?
About $30,000.
Okay. And remind us again how many employees you have?
It varies because I'm seasonal, but busy season 65 to 85, and right now I have 45.
Very good. Thank you so much. Mr. Nelson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Blake Nelson. I am an attorney with Helmuth & Johnson. I am also the chair of our construction law group, and I have been a construction attorney for over 30 years. I want to thank all of you for hearing this important bill and for your consideration today. Two common issues that face my subcontractor clients are being prevented from submitting an invoice for their work and not knowing when they will be paid. Regarding invoices, under the current law, a subcontractor may pursue payment or payment remedies, but they first must submit an invoice. The law specifically states that is a trigger. An invoice must have been submitted. Unfortunately, sometimes general contractors will impede that process. They will often require that invoices be submitted through a case management or a project management software, but then they will set up the software to either block or limit submitting invoices. Regarding payment transparency, the current law states that a subcontractor must be paid within 10 days after the public agency pays the general contractor. If they're not paid within that time period, then the general contractor will face remedies by that subcontractor potentially. They have certain claims they can make under Minnesota law. But the payment process is opaque, and subcontractors are often left in the dark as to when payments are actually made and received by the general contractor, and sometimes when a subcontractor asks the general contractor if they've been paid, the general contractor says they have not. A lot of these subcontractors are small businesses, and the intent of House File 1234 is to make sure that subcontractors can submit invoices for their work and learn when the general contractor has been paid. In the amendment before you today, we've significantly revised the language of the original bill to accommodate concerns that were raised by public owners and general contractors. And over the last year, we've participated in multiple stakeholder meetings and made significant concessions. For example, originally this bill did require that the public agencies would be proactively transparent and notify subcontractors when payments were made on every project. However, after working through the concerns that were raised by the public owners, we adopted the alternate approach that they proposed and that they believe is workable. Under the amendment before you today, a subcontractor therefore must request the payment information, and then the public agencies must provide it within 7 days. In the end, we hope that this ask and answer approach based off the public owner's language is better for all parties and leads to more transparency and better working relationships with prompter payment. House File 1234, as has been stated, is a bipartisan support with both sides, and it has the support of 16 trade associations. We will continue to work with the few organizations that are interested in additional changes, but we believe that this amendment represents a lot of hard work, a lot of concessions, and we hope that this committee will pass this bill. I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to stay for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. I think I've asked you this question once before because we've had you in committee and talked about this issue previously. So on the monies that are owed, and we just heard from Ms. Hoffman that it could be up to $30,000 for a particular job. The money that is owed, is that kept in an escrow account and or in some other account? And does that money that is owed eventually bear interest for the person who owes it so that by holding it, they eventually get some lift off of the project or what?
It's not required to be held in any type of an escrow account. There's not a segregation or a trust account or anything that a general contractor is required to implement in order to hold that money. So it's generally just floated amongst all the rest of their cash that they have on hand. Certainly, I assume that any general contractor could earn interest by keeping that money for a period of time. There are remedies for subcontractors to seek recovery of interest from general contractors for late payments. That particular statute, though, A, doesn't start running until they've submitted an invoice, and also states that that interest is only owed on undisputed payments. So it's very common for a general contractor to simply say that the payment is disputed. I don't know Ms. Hoffman's current circumstances, but there is, in short answer to your question, there is no segregation responsibility, no trust account or anything from a general contractor's point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Members, questions? Seeing none, I see next. I'm going there. I got it. Who does? Representative Bonner, to your question, and then I'm going to call Cap O'Rourke up, who is next on the testifier list.
So thank you for that, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott, and to the testifiers. You know, first, I actually think we've seen this bill before, and you know that I agree that we need to make sure that subcontractors are getting paid in a reasonable amount of time. Small businesses just don't have the capital to float for such a long time, so it's really important. But I'm curious about the language in the DE on 3.5 to 3.7, and then it appears again on 5.1 and 5, oh, sorry, starting at 4.33 to 5.3. That language strikes me as a little bit unusual, and I'm hoping you could maybe give me a little more background or explanation on it. When it says that when an invoice is required, prohibiting or delaying submittal of the invoice is contrary to public policy. So I'm not sure, I mean, I guess that's true, but it seems odd to add that language. But, and it is void and unenforceable. And it doesn't say that you can't do it. It says that it's void and unenforceable. That seems like an interesting word choice.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you for those comments and the question. The root of this particular language primarily stems from the advent of the construction project management software. As I testified previously, not every general contractor does this, but it is not uncommon for them to require the use of project management software to do everything, including submission of invoices, And they will add specific language to their contracts that in fact states if you try to submit an invoice outside the software, it's either going to delay the process or they will reject the invoice. But then when a subcontractor attempts to submit the invoice through the software, they find that it's rejected because it's set up on the side of the general contractor to block them. Or they will alternatively set very narrow windows for submission of invoices that if you miss that super narrow window on a monthly basis, then you have to wait till next month. So the purpose of this language is to say that that practice is against public policy and is not an enforceable practice. In other words, a general contractor can't do that.
Representative Bonner, follow up.
Thank you. And I don't contest any of that. In fact, I understand the intent. I'm just saying the void and unenforceable language seems like an odd language choice. Rather than just saying it's not permitted for you to delay or to prohibit or delay submittal of an invoice, we're instead saying in a very odd way that it's unenforceable. And I guess I'm just giving some feedback here that maybe we should explore whether that's the right language to make it clear that it is in fact prohibited. We know that it's against public policy because we know what Minnesota law states. That's fine. But it just, that particular word choice gives me a little bit of pause, and I'd like to see clarity in it because I also want to keep in mind that the individuals using this piece of statute are in fact generally subcontractors, right? And when they are probably not well versed in legalese. So making sure that our language choices are easily enforceable and that they are clear to the average person seems like it would probably be good policy. So just throwing that out there for consideration. But thank you for the bill.
Representative Sexton.
Just a couple of questions for you, Mr. Nelson. How often are there disputes over percentage of progress when you're going for progress payments as well as substantial completion of the subcontractor's work?
Mr. Nelson.
That's not an uncommon dispute. There can certainly be a debate over whether a submitted invoice covers the appropriate amount of work. And of course, nothing in the amendment here is saying that an invoice that's submitted is correct or has to be accepted. So there could certainly and is often the case where a general contractor perhaps might question an invoice or say this is not for the, you know, it's not correct. As far as substantial completion, that's also commonly disputed. There is a statute, there's usually a definition in the contract as to what substantial completion means. Typically what that says is that the work has been completed to the extent that it can be used for its intended purpose, subject to minor, what they call punch list items that need to be completed. That is commonly debated, and it is actually quite common for a general contractor to withhold what we refer to as retainage, which is the final a final percentage of the project funds that is held for that purpose. So it's not uncommon for there to be a dispute about essentially whether you're substantially complete. And it's very it's often the case where a subcontractor may submit an invoice for that work and get pushback. You know, you're not owed that money. The problem that they're facing here that we're trying to address today, though, is sometimes they can't even submit the invoice.
Representative Sexton, follow up, or are you good?
No follow up. I'm very familiar with that. I just want to make sure the rest of the committee heard that.
Thank you, Representative Sexton. Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm a little concerned about on line 5.6, the word procedure, because a procedure could be any protocol which would potentially cover the circumstance that you just described, which is somebody actually reviews the invoice and says you can't submit this because it's for a different project. You know, that would be a procedure that would delay or prohibit somebody from submitting an invoice. The other question I have is, you know, the language referencing on 5.7 to 5.8 referencing the fact that it would be contrary to public policy, I assume that is to sort of reset the balance in a potential arbitration such that an arbitration award would be appealable if the arbitrator ruled against or ruled in favor of the general contractor, because then it would be against public policy, and that would be one reason for setting aside the award. Is that why that language is in there?
We're going to go to Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, I think, Representative, you're looking at the actual bill and not the DE amendment.
Sorry. I apologize. Sorry.
So here's what I would suggest. We have agreement amongst the chairs that this is going to go to labor and then come back. We can have these discussions offline. We can also have them when it goes to labor. We can have them when it comes back here, so that we can make sure that everybody is comfortable with some of the intricacies of the language, and everybody has an opportunity to perhaps talk to Chair Scott and or her testifier as we proceed, unless you have questions to the DE, Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Sorry, that question is to the DE. I apologize for the line mess up, but that is lines 4.31 through lines 5.2.
Chair Scott. Would you like that repeated, Chair Scott? Mr. Nelson. Representative Luger-Nicolai, would you repeat the lines?
Yes. So I'm looking at the DE1 and lines 4.31 through lines 5.2. This is the language referring to when an invoice is required, prohibiting or delaying it is contrary to public policy, which is a basis for setting aside an arbitration award. And I'm wondering if that's the reason for including that particular phrase.
Mr. Nelson.
Could you repeat the part about the arbitration award? I didn't quite understand what you were saying there. I'm sorry.
Representative yes. Luger-Nicolai.
Okay. So if we define as a matter of statute whether something is contrary to public policy, and we state that explicitly in the law, that means that an arbitrator considering whether or not there had been a breach would be governed by that language, correct?
Mr. Nelson.
An arbitrator or a judge, correct?
Correct. Okay.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
So that would kind of limit the scope of choices that they have in making a determination of what had occurred, correct?
Mr. Nelson.
So if an arbitrator were to consider that language, my opinion is that they would decide or would need to decide that if, in fact, there was conduct or a contractual clause seeking to prohibit or block invoices, that that action was void and not something that is enforceable, so that the subcontractor would have remedies to still pursue payment.
Representative Luger-Nicolai, are we good?
That's good.
Okay. We will now move on to Mr. Cap O'Rourke. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. I want to thank Representative Scott. The DE amendment goes a long way to fixing a lot of our concerns with this issue. As many of you know, many of our small cities have very limited staff, often one or two people inside. And so we want to make sure that we have no problems with the intent of this legislation. We want to make sure that it is as simple as it can be for our staff to comply and provide this information. So the changing from the proactive mandatory notification to the reactive along with written is a huge step. I think the last step that, and we're working with stakeholders on this, is just to make sure that when a subcontractor reaches out to a public agency, that our staff does not have to jump through notable hoops to confirm that they are a subcontractor on the project. And we are working with stakeholders on that. We just don't. Right now, if a general contractor has a project with one of our small cities, we don't always, sometimes it happens, but we don't always have a list of who all the subcontractors are on this. So if someone contacts our office, we want a simplified way to make sure we know that they're on the list and we can provide that payment information. But other than that, we think the DE amendment is a huge step forward, and we support trying to create additional transparency for these contracts and these subcontractors.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Members, questions of Mr. O'Rourke? Seeing none. Anybody else from the public wish to testify? Please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, my name is Kirk Peterson. I'm one of the lobbyists for Hennepin County. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk real quickly. I'll keep my remarks brief because a lot of this has already been covered. We do want to thank the author for bringing this bill forward and for all of the work that has been done, been very responsive to a lot of our concerns, and want to make sure we are clear that if subcontractors are not getting paid, that is a very serious issue and should not be tolerated. Hennepin County has worked hard to develop relationships and implement policies to attract small business enterprises, particularly women-owned, veteran-owned, minority-owned companies. It's a big part of our business model. And so if there's any kind of a breakdown in that system, we want to be part of addressing that. Counties, cities, general contractors, subcontractors have been meeting over the last couple days. I think we have a much better understanding of where we're all coming from, and we appreciate their being willing to work with us on that. I won't go into a lot of the details on what has already been said with the notification and the invoicing or the notification process, other than to say it is a lot of work, especially as Mr. O'Rourke just pointed out, for smaller cities or counties that don't always have the resources for this. It's just another unfunded mandate for them to be able to pull this together. We are willing to do it, but it is something that should be taken into account. More specifically, to address what Representative Bonner was talking about, our bigger concern deals with the section with delays in invoicing or prohibiting of invoicing. Invoicing and paying of invoices is not a one-step process. It's actually a pretty complicated system, as Mr. Nelson pointed out. Subcontractors submit invoices to the general contractor. In our case, general contractors then submit those to the architect, who then submits it to the county for payment. And so it's a project there, but what if there's a change order? If there's a change order that's being presented, there's not always an invoice to go along with that. So under the wording of this bill, does that mean if there's a change order and there isn't an invoice that has been paid yet, does that constitute a delay that would then void and make unenforceable the entire public construction contract? Similarly, with a discrepancy among progress reports, if an invoice is submitted that says 50% of the work has been done, but in reality only 30% of the work has been completed, and the entire invoice isn't paid on that 50% amount, does that constitute a delay or a prohibition in an invoice getting submitted or getting paid, and does that constitute the entire contract being considered void and unenforceable? So those are just some of the concerns that we had. We did meet, as I said, we met earlier this week. We have provided some language to the subcontractors. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that the author has seen that, so I'd be happy to share that with you, that we think addresses that concern with the delay in the invoicing provisions. Unless Mr. Nelson has already had some comments on it. But again, thank you for your time. More than willing to keep working on this. It's going to another committee, so we'll keep working on it and see if we can come to some agreement on it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. One last, is there anybody else from the public that would like to testify? Okay, Chair Scott, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the good conversation here this morning. And we will continue to work on this language. Again, we had three very large stakeholder meetings during the interim. And it was a little disheartening to have somebody come kind of at the last minute. But we are still willing to work on this. And it will come back to the committee if that's the wish after we've settled on final language. And I want to thank my testifiers as well.
Okay. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. I so appreciate the work that you've done on this bill. It's come a long way since the first time we've heard it. And so thank you very much for your diligence in doing this work. As I have stated privately to you, I will state publicly, when contractors don't pay their subcontractors, that's a bad thing. And I find it difficult and that the agencies and the counties are bearing the cost for the contractors' bad behavior, right? They should be paying. And I would think about possibly as you go forward, having some sort of list of what contractors are noted for not paying their subs. because that should be something that we take into consideration when we are issuing contracts with public dollars. So thank you very much.
Chair Scott, any reply?
No.
Okay. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1234, as amended, be referred to labor. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? You're on your way.
Thank you.
Next, before the committee, we will have Representative Sexton with House File 3528. Representative Sexton, as you are a member of the committee, I will allow you to move the bill before the committee, and we are sending this to the General Register. So if you'd like to move your bill.
I would. Good morning, Chair Nash, Chair Cleburne, fellow members of the State Government Policy Committee.
One moment.
Oops.
This bill has a cost, a fiscal note. Does that not need to go to Ways and Means?
Yeah, they're going to be speaking to that notion. So we'll.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So once again, Representative Sexton has moved House File 3528 before the committee with a referral to the General Register. The conversation around fiscal note or absorption of cost will be discussed by the testifier. Representative Sexton, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Continue my introduction. Good morning to everybody, and good morning to our outstanding staff. House File 3520 is a technical bill supporting Minnesota Barber Examiner's Board. I would like to highlight the token $1,000 annual fiscal impact, which seems minor in the big picture. Finally, I'm joined today by Mr. Brent, I'm going to say Grabanowski.
That's correct.
All right. Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. Mr. Grabanowski will highlight the technical changes in the bill and stand for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Grabanowski, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brent Grabanowski. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. I'm here representing the board, who is responsible for developing this bill in coordination with licensees and stakeholders in the barbering industry. The bill will remove barriers of entry for those interested in entering the profession of barbering in Minnesota. The bill allows the board to conduct additional and more frequent exams, which will give barber students additional opportunities to prove that they can safely provide barber services and get them out into the workforce faster. There's currently a requirement that barber students who fail the registered barber exam be required to complete an additional 500 hours of barber school. That amounts to another 3 months of school and considerable expense. This bill would remove that requirement. There's language in the bill that modifies our examination fees. Those changes were necessary to match the new structure of our examination process and will not result in an increase of fees to licensees. The fiscal note shows a very small increase in expenses to the board. The board can absorb those costs, and we are not seeking an increase to our appropriation.
Mr. Grabanowski, let me interrupt you really quick. There was some distraction up here. Could you state that again for me, please?
Sure. The fiscal note shows a very small increase in expenses to the board. The board can absorb those costs, is not seeking an increase to our appropriation. Finally, this bill will incorporate recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. This includes providing licensed cosmetologists credit for overlapping training and reducing duplicative education requirements if a cosmetologist is interested in becoming a registered barber. I thank you for considering this bill, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions regarding it.
Representative Sexton, anything further?
Nothing further.
All right. Members' questions? Chair Cleburne.
So the fiscal note is not in our packet. I realize that it's a small fiscal note, but at the same time, we don't have available to us the assumptions that are in the fiscal note. And it should go to the whole committee.
Representative Sexton, if you would. Chair Cleburne, my apologies. If you would like, I can ask Ms. Roberts to verify that the fiscal note is indeed what we received and that is the amount. If you would, Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, there is indeed a fiscal note on this bill. It shows two different pieces of information. First is the increased expenditures to the board as referenced of $2,000 per year. And so that was the piece that the board would absorb. There's also a revenue increase of $1,000 per year. And under our budget rules, we will actually be tracking that $1,000 as this bill moves forward. But so there's a net change to the general fund of $1,000 per year. To remind people that the board is funded through a direct general fund appropriation, but any fees they collect go to the general fund, not to the board.
And members, before I recognize Chair Cleaborn, I do see you.
Thank you.
For many years, I've had conversations with others, including various speakers, and this is truly a de minimis number of dollars, so that it is not something that would upset the apple cart that much. But Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you. And it's not the net amount of the change that I have a problem with. And I actually support the bill and the work that you're trying to do. I want to be perfectly clear about that. But when you talk about expenditures and revenues, right, there are changes in the bill that change who pays and who benefits. Is that correct?
Representative Sexton or the testifier, Ms. Grabanowski?
The changes to the fees won't result in any changes to the students. Right now it costs $205 for someone to go from starting barber school through their first year of becoming a barber. And after this bill, it'll be the same $205.
Right. Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you. And please don't be annoyed. I'm trying to figure this out myself as I'm reading the fiscal note.
Okay. Good.
So on page 2 of the fiscal note, it does say that their additional initial barber registration fee has a revenue gain of $17,600, correct?
Mr. Grabanowski.
That's correct.
Okay. And then,
Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you. And then the next line says the elimination of the barber students being required to purchase the home study course will have a revenue loss of $16,500, correct?
Mr. Grabanowski.
That's correct.
Okay, so the first line,
Chair Cleaborn,
impacts 220 students, and then the second line impacts 220 students. So are those the same students?
Mr. Grabanowski?
They are.
Okay, awesome.
Chair Cleaborn.
That's good to know. Okay. And then the elimination of the retake fee, that impacts 30 other students. Is that correct?
Mr. Grabanowski?
That is correct.
Okay.
Chair Cleaborn.
That's all right. I'm just trying to make sure that we all know.
Speaking through the chair.
Thank you so much. I still believe that this needs to go to Ways and Means and not to the general register, as it does have a fiscal note.
Fine. Chair Cleaborn, I will ask if we make the referral to Ways and Means. Are you going to vote the bill out?
Yes, that was our intent. Thank you.
All right. The chair will make a motion to revise the referral to go to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Sexton, to your bill. And once again, the chair will renew my motion, or you can do it as well, to refer it to Ways and Means, just to make sure that we get this thing going.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nash, Co-Chair Cleaborn, fellow members of State Government Finance Committee. Obviously, this is a very technical bill. It's corrections that will help the barber board be more effective and more efficient. I urge you to support, and I renew my motion to move it to Ways and Means.
All right. With that, Representative Sexton has renewed his motion to move House File 3528 to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're on your way. Okay. The vice chair will take over for a second while I move to...
All right, Chair Nash, would you like to move your bill, House File 3679, before the committee?
I will move 3679 to come before the committee with a referral to move to the general register.
Thank you, Chair Nash. To your bill.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, this is a very simple, straightforward bill that would allow for reports that we receive, typically printed on paper, accumulating costs. to be allowed to be printed to a PDF sent to members. And then if so chose, you can ask for a copy in paper to be delivered to your hot little hands. It's that simple.
Do you have any testifiers to your bill?
I don't.
Okay. Member discussion? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Nash. Love it. We should do this with far more of this paper that we get. So thank you.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're not eliminating any reports, so any West Wing fans know that Winnie will not be coming to bark at us for eliminating any reports. All the reports are still available. You can, if you feel like you need to scribble notes, you can just ask for one, and it will magically appear in your inbox. So,
Representative Kraft, follow up.
Yay. No.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I, too, like the bill and appreciate that we are living in a more modern age, so I want to thank you for that for sure. The one thing I will note is that I did not see a fiscal note. Do we know what the savings will be?
Chair Nash.
No, we don't have a note on it, but just by virtue of the fact that we're eliminating paper, we're going to see a savings. I can get that for you later, but since it's not going to actually cost anything, we're saving money, we can move it along to its next destination.
Co-Chair Bonner.
I think that is, of course, our intent, but I just wanted to make sure that we're, curiosity, because there isn't one in the packet, it would be helpful to know what that savings would be.
Duly noted.
Chair Nash. Okay. Okay, Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think Winnie made pretty clear in that episode she preferred to be called Winifred.
Say that again, please.
I said I think she preferred to be called Winifred.
Chair Nash.
Well played. Well played. Mr. Chair, if you would allow me to renew my motion to send...
Chair Clevorn.
Oh, here we go.
I would encourage you to reach out to Chair Mueller. This is something that she has been chewing on my ear about for weeks now, about all of the paper and reports that have come. I think she would be an excellent co-author for you. Thank you.
Very good.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we often hear the term sticky iPad kid. We'll just be more sticky and more iPad kids as we read our reports electronically. And I think this is just another great way to save some money. Just don't tell anybody from the paper manufacturing region of the state. And with that, I renew my motion that 3679 be sent to the General Register.
With that, Chair Nash renews his motion to move House File 3679 to the General Registry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nash, you have another bill that you'd like to move before the committee?
Yes.
House File 3680.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3680 to come before the committee with a referral to the General Register.
To your bill, Chair Nash.
And I do have a testifier if he would like to come forward. Mr. Chair and members, this bill was This bill was a result of a meeting in my office, I think right before we started session, and the conversation was for the ability for the Legislative Budget Office to go back and effectively look at how accurate fiscal notes that we received were. Sort of a spot check. I don't think that would go back and review every single fiscal note, but you know, obviously here in the legislature, we like to pursue as accurate a fiscal note or impact as possible. So that's the genesis of the bill. I do have a testifier, and I will allow him to proceed with the
You state
testimony.
Your name and who you're with.
Chair and members, my name is Christian Larson, Director of the Legislative Budget Office. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to House File 3680 today. So essentially, under current law, the Legislative Budget Office has access to data in the creation of a fiscal note. So if a fiscal note is created, the Legislative Budget Office can reach out to the agency and say, can you please provide the information that was used to develop that fiscal note? This bill would expand the authority from the LBO to ask for information on the implementation of that policy related to that fiscal note. So essentially, what we can accomplish is a variance analysis from what was the fiscal note estimate to what actually was implemented, and we can compare and see how accurate our fiscal notes were.
Chair Nash. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
And so what we think this does is accomplish a few things for the Legislative Budget Office and for the fiscal process. We believe this type of variance analysis would allow for the development of more accurate information, ideally through the fiscal process, if we can go back and check our work, both for the Legislative Budget Office to make sure we're signing off on things that are accurate, and for agencies to receive information back and say, okay, this was, you know, this was or wasn't as accurate, and can we apply that going forward? And so we think that could be applied in performing this type of variance analysis. We also think we can inform the legislature on the accuracy of certain fiscal estimates, and so if there's a particular policy that was implemented in a fiscal note and that's of interest, we could do a variance analysis on that. We also provide an additional level of accountability to the Legislative Budget Office and to state entities completing fiscal notes. This was a topic that was discussed by the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission on the December 17th, 2025 commission meeting. There's discussion around, there's a presentation that Chair Neuer and Senator Pratt asked the Legislative Budget Office to come forward and present on what this variance analysis could look like, considerations. In terms of considerations for this type of work, what this variance analysis could accomplish and how you would put it into practice, there are some considerations to think about. First, who would get to select such an analysis? It could be the LBO in consultation with health and nonpartisan staff. We piloted, the Legislative Budget Office piloted such analysis in 2022, where we picked out four items to go back and select and see what kind of resources this would take to accomplish and do that type of analysis of what we could and couldn't accomplish. Perhaps the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission could play a role into determining what type of items should be reviewed. So there'd be a process for collecting feedback from the full legislature, something similar to what the OLA does in collecting feedback. Other considerations, this can be a complex and challenging type of analysis. A lot of things can go into this, so depending on the complexity of the program, there could be variables that impact the kind of the variance that are outside of those standard assumptions in the fiscal note. And so making sure that that's understood, well communicated, embracing the complexity of this analysis, but also trying to communicate that in a clear way, I think certainly can be a challenge, but can be done in a responsible way. The type of resources necessary within the Legislative Budget Office. The question is, how many of these, as Chair Nash suggested, how many of this would you look at? Both for agencies and Legislative Budget Office, that's a question. How much resources are required? And then finally, what is to be looked at? So you could look at a single fiscal note front to back and say, let's look at all the assumptions in a fiscal note. How did that play out? Where do those variances happen? Or you could look at a single subject and say, let's look at all IT costs across several fiscal notes and compare that to what actually was implemented for a particular set of IT costs or FTE costs or whatever it might be for a single subject within a fiscal note and do an analysis that way. But this statute would just allow for the Legislative Budget Office to perform that type of analysis. From there, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Chair Nash, did you want to add anything?
I believe there are probably some member questions if we'd like.
Members? Chair Cleet? Representative Luger Nicolai.
Yeah, I have a question, which is, does the LBO currently believe that there is data to which they don't have access, that this expands their access to?
Chair Nash or Mr. Larson?
Chair, Representative. So under current statute, it's very clearly stated that we have access to information that would allow for the development of fiscal note. This would expand the requirement of access to data. That doesn't mean if we didn't ask at this moment, agencies wouldn't provide it. In fact, when we piloted this kind of report in 2022, agencies worked with us and provided information. So there's nothing prohibiting agencies from providing information to us currently. This would just say, in those circumstances that the Legislative Budget Office is performing analysis and the agency says no, we would point to statute and say we do have that authority.
Representative Luger Nicolai.
Thanks, Chair Davis. In your experience, an agency did not balk at your requests. They said, yes, here's the data.
Mr. Larson.
Chair and members, our experience is yes, that happened in that one time. We certainly had times in fiscal notes where we have had to point statute and say, yes, we would like that data. Now, for the vast majority of time, agencies are working along with us to provide the fiscal estimates to the legislature, and our working relationship is strong and well done, and we have good experiences. But there's inherently in an oversight role, there's going to be times where conflict is inherent in the process, and so this would allow us to make sure we have that authority But to answer your question, we didn't have an experience where agencies said no the first time we did this.
Chair Nash.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Luger-Nicolai, there have been times in the past where data is not always shared quickly or that it's wanted to be shared. So this would remove those roadblocks because obviously everybody's striving for accuracy and giving the LBO statutory authority to access those pieces of data really makes our job easier and more complete so we have a better picture as to what it is that we're trying to get done. So just removing another hurdle that in the creation of the LBO may not have been put into statute. So this makes it so that they can do their job easier, more effective, and that they can access the data that they need to get fiscal notes done in as complete a picture as possible.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you. Is the LBO subject to the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Larson.
Chair and members. So under the current statute, we have fiscal statute in, or there's data practice law related to us in 1364, and this is adjusting 1364 subdivision 4, where we are allowed access to this data, but we're not public data requests don't come. We don't have to supply public data requests in the same way the legislature does not.
Vice Chair Bonner.
So I'm sorry, I didn't actually get an answer to the question. The question was, is the LBO subject to the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Larson.
Chair members, my apologies, no.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So, well, first of all, I will just say, you know, I have expressed some frustration with fiscal notes in the past and challenged a few in my day. So I actually like the idea of this bill. But here's where I'm concerned. Depending on the data that we're requesting, if we're talking about things like intermingling data on federal tax information or from the Social Security Administration or other types of sensitive data in the review process, and the LBO is not subject to the Data Practices Act, how can we be assured that that data will be safely utilized and minimized within who has access to that data and how it's shared publicly?
Mr. Larson.
Your members. We agree that the security of data is of the utmost importance, and we would do our very best to make sure we protect our data. We have process now where we have access to data that is private data, secure data, through the fiscal process currently that we make sure that it's not. We have processes and procedures in place to make sure that information is not shared. But thank you for the question.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to encapsulate what Mr. Larson just said, they currently have data that they are doing a better than adequate job of protecting, so that adding data is already being protected. I don't know that we have any fear of them having access to the concern that you bring, Representative Bonner.
Vice Chair Bonner, follow up.
Thank you. And, you know, I don't doubt that they are doing their best. I will readily accept that assumption. But I also want to be very clear that we are living in a digital age in which sensitive data matters. And I think you know that, Chair Nash. I like this bill. I'm being very upfront about that. But I do have concerns about the LBO not being subject to the Data Practices Act when they may be interacting with sensitive data. And it would be my hope that we would either consider whether or not the LBO should be subject to the Data Practices Act, or what other assurances or language we could add into the bill to ensure that that data gets protected. I like the intent of the bill. I like the core of the bill. I just want to make sure that that data gets protected, and I'm not sure that the language as it stands today currently does that in a way that makes me feel comfortable, and I realize that they are probably being good stewards, and I hope they are. I want to assume positive intent, but I would love to see some additional language on this bill that address that issue.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, I checked with Mr. Larson when we were listening. They have not had a breach. They have not had anything happen. So I will make you this offer that
I'm more than happy to bring an author's amendment on the floor if you would like to work with me to tighten language up to meet something that you would be comfortable with. So I think that, once again, we are on the same page as it relates to cybersecurity. But given the fact that Mr. Larson has said that they have not had a breach, they handle sensitive data as it is, I think that they're doing an admirable job and that we should support them in trying to provide a greater level of detail and accuracy by going back and looking at they're spot checking effectively. They're going to go back and pick a handful of things and come back and say, hey, guess what? We're either overestimating this or we're underestimating that. That gives us the ability to do our jobs better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. First of all, I don't know if this is better for Mr. Larson or for you, Chair Nash. Doesn't the budget forecast already kind of serve as a means to check on the work of agencies and the cost of enacted legislation?
Chair Nash, Mr. Larson.
Well, once again, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Freiberg, this is for the fiscal note process. So we're trying to create a greater level of detail on fiscal notes. And I would allow Mr. Larson to chime in on that.
Mr. Larson.
Chair and members, so in some regards, the forecast does check the current spending, and especially on forecasted programs. There's a couple things to think about. This is on the fiscal part, kind of on those direct spend programs, the direct appropriation programs, there isn't inherently, there's just a set budget that moves forward from year to year. So here's the base budget that was previously appropriated of ongoing funding. There isn't inherently a process to go back on those type of programs, say what was actually spent versus what would move forward in kind of the base budget, which is at that appropriation. It doesn't mean that the communication's not happening. Again, I'm not on that side of your work, but I'm assuming at times the fiscal staff will go and try to figure out what a program actually spends or whatever else it might be. But there's not a formal process in the same way that the forecast would come out and set a new expense for kind of those forecasted programs. At the same time, there's also a possibility that an analysis of the kind of this variance analysis would bring to light certain outcomes within forecasted programs. Those forecasted programs are inherently going to be much more complex and challenging to do this type of variance analysis. So that needs to be considered when performing this type of work. But to answer your question, yes, in some regard, the forecast does answer what is the actual expense of these programs.
And Mr. Chair, I would add to that that the forecasts only come out twice a year. During the conduction of our time here, it would be probably quite helpful and illustrative to have something that's not just twice a year.
Chair Freiberg, follow up.
Yeah, thank you for that information. I guess second question is, it seems like doing this work after legislation has been adopted might require agencies to get pretty far into some details of legislation. I'm just wondering if there might be a cost to agencies in doing that and if a fiscal note's been requested on this bill.
Mr. Larson.
Chairs and members, there's not been a fiscal request on this bill. I don't believe, I'm not 100% sure on that, but I don't believe that's the case. And in terms of cost to an agency, there certainly is resources required to respond to our questions. As much as possible, we would try to do the work internally, pull information and communicate it. So we can pull communication from or information from the accounting system and say, here's how this appropriation kind of spend out. But in terms of understanding what drove variances, that would definitely happen at the agency level, that we wouldn't have access to that type of information, right? So like how things actually played out and why they played out a certain way. So that would be resources of the agency. And I think it would come down to the complexity of the program is determine how much resources are required.
Chair Freiberg, follow up?
No, not at this point.
Thank you. Okay, we will go to a Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, can you be really crisp on what problem we're trying to solve with this?
Chair Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and then I'll let Mr. Larson weigh in on this. So I think, well, the problem is accuracy. We want to make sure that we're actually being as accurate as possible. I mean, you and I have both had time in the corporate world. We always go back and review things that we either forecasted. Myself, on the sales side of thing, I would sit down with my sales team and usually tell them that their forecast was not as accurate as they were trying to convince me that it was. But certainly from a fiscal perspective, you want to
you want to go back and double check the work that's been put out there. Honestly, I hope that that we find out that we are doing an excellent job, but we won't know unless we go back and analyze things after the fact. So the problem, to your point, or the conundrum that we find ourselves in is we don't know how accurate we're getting when we get fiscal notes, either information from agencies or as we make various assumptions moving forward. We want to make sure that those assumptions were actually as accurate as they were projected, and I'll let Mr. Larson weigh in on that as well.
Mr. Larson.
Chair members, so this is really a, from the Legislative Budget Office perspective, this is a quality control mechanism. If we think about what the fiscal process is supposed to be for the legislature, it's supposed to be timely and accurate. We have relatively good measures of timeliness. We can measure how quickly fiscal notes are moving through the system, how many days it takes to complete a fiscal note, how many times they're completed by a due date, whatever that might be. We don't have a system to go back and check the accuracy of those estimates. And so this is really trying to address that piece of it from the Legislative Budget Office perspective is, can we build in some quality control that says the statutory obligation the Legislative Budget Office has is performing in the way it's supposed to for the legislature.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would suggest quality control, I get it, but we don't know that there's a problem, right? I mean, I might suggest that the first step of something like this is to go, you know, look at 20 of them, 25 of them, and say, were they accurate or not? The other question I would have is, this is a new function for the LBO, right? You're not performing this today. So, I mean, how much more work is this going to be for you, and how many more resources are you going to need to do it?
Mr. Larson.
To the second question, I'm sorry, chairs and members, for the second question first, in terms of resources, I think it's really a question of how this would scale. So we did pilot this in 2022, and in the interim, we reviewed four relatively simple bills, and we could manage that within our current workload. If this were, when we did a review of what this type of variance analysis would look like and what this looked like in other states, there's two states that do this on a consistent basis, like a regular recurring report. There's the Utah legislature and the Tennessee legislature. In Utah, they look at over 200 budget items per year, and that would inherently be a large resource requirement both for the Legislative Budget Office and for agencies. In Tennessee, they look, under statute, they have to look between 5 and 10. If you were to pick a number between 5 and 10, we think that's a resource allocation that we could manage within our current resources. Again, it really depends on the complexity of the program, but that's something that we could manage within our current system and quite honestly would improve our ability to do fiscal note evaluations moving forward. And so it would be a valuable use of our time in the interim. We certainly have lots of work. We support the Taxpayers Review Commission, which is plenty. But beyond that, this is something that would really support our work.
Representative Kraft, follow-up?
Yeah, just a point. So thank you, Mr. Chair. But this language doesn't say, you know, do for a few of them. This language gives you broad authority to do it for every fiscal note. So, based on what you just said, I'm surprised that there's no fiscal note associated with this. We have a problem. I will summarize. We have something that we don't know if it's a problem or not, that we're going to give broad authority to you to create a whole new set of, if you actually were to implement this, right, based on this language, growing the size of the organization. So I see the issue, but I just think this is right now needs a lot of work.
If you want. Mr. Larson.
Chair members, yes, thank you for the question. In terms of what the bill really requires, so technically the bill doesn't require any type of output. I think that is a really good question of how this gets operationalized. And I think for the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission, that would make a lot of sense for them to address and quite honestly they want to bring that back as a discussion next interim of how this type of analysis would work. But in terms of identifying a problem, absolutely we don't know to what extent fiscal notes are not accurate, and that I think is a challenge for us. And so being able to answer that question would be really important, which this language would help facilitate our ability to do that.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm a little bit confused by some of the questions here because with normal accounting practices, the agencies should already have a database so that they are ensured that they're not overspending than what was proposed. So I assume that everybody can use that database and get the numbers. I'm somewhat concerned about will this give us the delta of the cost of the overhead, actual overhead cost by agency, and also give us a delta by agency, so we understand that we really got a good handle on these agencies and maybe not these others. And then we got the state Supreme Court. I don't see the AG or the state auditor listed, and we do some budgeting, I think, for them. But that can be offline and later. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Cleaver.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you. So I heard some things that are really confusing and concerning to me. So one, the motion was to the general register. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That is correct. Yep.
Thank you. Okay. But we are changing chapter 13.64. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair? That is correct.
Chair
Cleaver?
Thank you, Chair Davis. I believe that requires a trip to judiciary. Okay, not to the general register.
Mr. Chair?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Cleaborne, if that secures your vote to move it on, which you've already shaken your head that you will not, so I'll just keep it as is and allow you to cast a vote against accurate fiscal notes.
Chair Cleaborne.
Thank you, Chair Davis. Well, I'm not voting against accurate fiscal notes. I believe that accurate fiscal notes are very important, and I believe that Mr. Larson would tell you at this moment that he believes his office is producing accurate fiscal notes. I can't believe that he would give us a current fiscal note that he believed to be inaccurate. Could I ask you, Mr. Larson, would you give us a fiscal note that you believed currently to be inaccurate?
Mr. Larson.
Chair and members, we do our very best to make sure the estimates are coming out accurate, and we believe when we sign off on fiscal notes, they are so.
Chair Cleaver.
Thank you. And I appreciate that because I do rely on your fiscal notes, and I believe that your department is doing the very best work they possibly can. So no disparagement to your department. I appreciate the work that you do. But I did hear words today that caused me pause in passing the bill out of committee today, right? It doesn't mean that I wouldn't do it at a future date, but today I have concerns. So we have no idea of the complexity of the issues that would be looked at. To Representative Kraft's statement, there is no process or limitation on the number of these reviews that would be done. Is that correct?
Chair Nash.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Chair Cleaver.
Thank you, Chair Davis. When we talk about variance analysis, which I believe was the phrase used today, those are incredibly time consuming and complicated. Is that correct, Mr. Larson?
Mr. Larson.
Chair and members, I apologize. Can you repeat that?
Yes, of course. I saw that you were having a side conversation. The phrase variance analysis. In your own words, those can be very complicated and resource intensive depending on what analysis, which agency or which legislation you're looking at. Is that correct?
Mr. Larson.
Chair members, that's accurate.
Thank you so much.
Chair Cleaver.
Thank you. And I believe I heard Mr. Larson say that if they do a complicated variance analysis of a large piece of legislation, that could be labor intensive for an agency. Is that correct?
Mr. Larson.
Chair members, that's correct.
Thank you very
much. Chair Cleaver.
Thank you, Chair Davis. So with that, I think we need to know what the fiscal note would actually be for that complicated large analysis scenario, and what the fiscal note analysis would be for let's say if you were to do 5 to 10, settle on a number for 8, with some process in place, because this legislation doesn't really tell me what the process would be. Chair Davis, if I may continue.
Chair Cleaver.
The other piece that I would really like to look at, and the question that I asked both of your office and of the OLA previously, is there overlap between this work? If we are looking at internal controls and if we are looking at quality controls, which I also believe I heard you mention in this, is that not the work of the OLA?
Mr. Larson.
Chair members, I apologize for the confusion on this. So this quality control would be for our office. So it's the control of the legislative budget office in the fiscal process. Certainly, OLA has performed a review of the fiscal process, I want to say, in 2012, when it was overseen by Minnesota Managing Budget. But for the most part, this would be an internal control as opposed to kind of some bigger, broader review of greater policy from the state.
Right. Chair Cleaver, we'd like to get to a vote.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Yep. One more follow-up. Just to his answer.
Briefly, yep.
Thank you. So when we talk about the work of the Legislative Budget Office and the work of the OLA, I would think that the OLA would actually look at the internal processes that you are using in analyzing the assumptions, and I would think that the OLA would look at the internal controls used both by agencies in providing this information and in the work and how it's delivered by your organization. That's why I say it's a confusion of the tasks, right? So when we're checking to see if your process and your controls are accurate and the agency's delivery of that information to you, I would think that would be the work of the OLA. That's my statement. So with that, I would encourage our members, while this work continues to make this bill better, I would ask for our members to vote no, but I would like to see this bill come back at a future date with some of these questions that we've discussed today clarified. And so for today, I'm asking our members to vote no on the bill.
Chair Nash, closing comments.
Thank you for the time. Members vote yes.
With that, Chair Nash renews his motion for House File 3680 to be referred to the General Registry. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nash.
Nash votes aye.
Representative Cleaver.
Chair Cleaver, no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy.
Clardy, no.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Jones excused. Representative Joy.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sexton.
Aye.
There being seven yeas and six nays, the bill does not advance and is laid over. Members, before we move on to Representative Freiberg's bill, Chair is going to take bring House file or Senate file 856 as amended before the committee. Senate file 856 is the OIG bill. It has received testimony. It has received amendments. And we are going to move it on to Judiciary. That is the referral. Members, and I will recognize you, Chair Cleaver.
Thank you.
We are running out of days. We are quickly running out of days. So at the end of this week, my co-chair has posted her agenda. It is not on that agenda. When we go to Tuesday of next week, I'm happy to bring the bill back again if we need to, but we're running out of days. At the Thursday meeting of next week, we don't have one because of the Eid break. And if this bill is truly as important as everyone says it is time to get it moving on to its next station. We're going to give you all an opportunity to do that today and recognize that changes can be made in the next committee stop, but if we do not move it on today, we are effectively killing this thing off. You know, we've heard that it's safe and snugly here in state government finance, but It is time to move this on if we are truly interested in an Office of Inspector General bill. The time is now. Waiting is not going to help this process at all. Introducing new bills delays the process with referrals and different things moving. The time is now. So, Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you very much. I would like to remind the committee that both the Senate author and other members of the working group that met on the first Tuesday following the working group reenactment all agreed in that working group that the bill is unconstitutional. Every one of them agreed to that in that working group. So I will remind the members of this committee that the bill is unconstitutional as currently written. The other thing I would like to remind the committee is that, one, this has not been posted for the public to come in and have any say, which is contrary to what we have done before in this committee. On, we last heard Senate File 856, of which I am a co-author on the bill, and we offered a DE amendment. The House author's amendment was not given a vote, even though the House author's amendment was brought forward. We heard the bill again on a second day where amendments were offered and rejected by this committee that would have made the bill constitutional. 9 amendments were offered, 2 were adopted. The 7 amendments were told that they had merit and that they should continue to be worked on before this bill would be heard again. There is the author of the bill has introduced the DE as a separate bill, which is before our body. And so I would ask our members on this side of the aisle to please vote no. As co-chair of this committee, will not send an unconstitutional bill out of this committee. Members on our side, please vote no.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. You know, once again, we did listen to the DE, and it was not adopted. We did listen to other amendments that were adopted. We recommended that the other amendments that had merit be adopted, perhaps in the judiciary, where they have greater expertise than this committee does. So, members, the chair is going to request a roll call to move House File or Senate File 856 as amended to the judiciary. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nash.
Nash votes aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn votes no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson aye.
Representative Clardy.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Jones excused. Representative Joy. Yes. Representative Kosnick.
Yes.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sexton.
Yes.
There being 7 yes, 6 no, 1 excused, the motion does not carry. Representative Freiberg, you're up with House File 1944. And we are, I believe, laying this bill over. Is your intent?
Sure. I move that House File 1944 be laid over for possible inclusion. And okay. I would move the A1 amendment, which just updates the years.
Okay. The author has the A1. Questions of the A1? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to lie, there's a lot of really important things happening in Minnesota right now, and I've not been prioritizing this bill, so I was rather surprised when you indicated you wanted to give it a hearing.
We're just trying to be friendly.
Yeah, no, that being said, if there were a time to give this bill a hearing, this would be it, when everyone in this room is tired and cranky because we needlessly lost an hour of sleep on Saturday night. Before I get into the bill, it's probably helpful just to give us some terminology here. So, daylight saving time, often misnomered as daylight savings time, is what we're on now, and there's more sunlight in the evening, as you may have noticed last night. Standard time is what we were on last week, when there's more sunlight in the morning. It's probably also helpful to give some history. I realize time is short, so I will keep this short. But under federal law, states have the authority to go to standard time permanently, and that's what states like Arizona do. However, states do not have the authority to go to daylight saving time permanently. Now, a few years ago, I authored a law with then-Senator Kiffmeyer to move Minnesota to permanent daylight saving time. That actually became law, but it only takes effect once Congress authorizes states to adopt permanent daylight saving time. As we all know, regardless of who's in charge, Congress tends not to act quickly. So this bill authorizes permanent standard time until Congress gives us authority to adopt permanent daylight saving time, at which point we will change our clocks one last time. Now, the sleep scientists will tell you that standard time aligns better with the human biology than daylight saving time, and you have written testimony reflecting that. Many people do have strong feelings about which system is preferable or whether we should change clocks at all. Personally, I do have a mild preference for daylight saving time, but my larger goal is to get rid of the time change, which needlessly disrupts our schedules. I felt this way since my kids were little and I was trying to sleep train them, and their sleep would get disrupted for what seemed like no good reason. Standard time is what Congress allows states to currently adopt, so this bill would implement permanent standard time. I did not request any testifiers here, but I don't know if anybody has signed up, so I see a hand over there, but I'll leave it to the chair's discretion.
Thank you, Representative. I do have two people who have signed up ahead of time to testify, Dr. Roxanne Pritchard and JP. If you would like to come and keep your testimony brief. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Roxanne Pritchard. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of St. Thomas. I'm a neuroscientist who studies sleep and mental health. Happy Sleep Awareness Week. So this bill gets to the heart of my professional calling and passion. I study how we can remove the barriers to good sleep that would enable better mental health for the community, that would offer better savings. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill, which has the clear support of education committees, the clear support of health committees. Permanent standard time basically keeps high noon noon, where like the sun is directly overhead at noon. It makes it easier to get up in the morning and easier to go to bed at night. We know there's a big increase in insomnia, and that's so hard for families like mine who have children trying to get to bed at a reasonable hour. So daylight saving time doesn't actually save daylight at all. It just kind of makes everybody wake up an hour earlier before their body's natural rhythm would want them to wake up. And that makes it harder for commuters, to families with children, to just basically function. We know that when we switch to daylight saving time, there are more heart attacks, there are more car accidents, there are more cases of insomnia. So I am here to offer my enthusiastic support for making a simple change that makes it so much better, that would have rippling health benefits for our community. And I'm happy to answer any questions if that helps deliberation.
Thank you, Dr. Pritchard. Questions, members, anyone? Seeing none, thank you very much. For Representative Kosnick.
Mr. Chair, when we're done with the bill.
Yeah, we have one more testifier and then we can get to your question. We have an online testifier, I believe. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Mr. JP, first name is J-A-Y, last name is P-E-A. I'm the president of the nonprofit Safe Standard Time. I'm a co-chair for the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time, a group of 8 nonprofits for health and safety. I'm also from Iowa, your neighbor to the south, and I want to urge a yes on House File 1944. Daylight saving time is simply a mandate to wake an hour earlier, which means that we're sleeping less. When you spring your clock forward, you now have a fast clock. Your alarm sounds an hour earlier every single day. And over the long term, this leads to a chronic deprivation of sleep. The lack of sleep is a serious problem in the United States. It increases accidents. It increases illnesses. It can even cost lives, and it definitely costs money. And it does not help save energy or increase productivity. In fact, it does the opposite of those claims. A lot of people who think that they like daylight saving time, in most cases, actually simply like summer, because we do DST in summer, so there's an emotional association there. But changing the clock does not make the seasons happen. Nature makes that happen. Standard time is the honest clock that was taught to me by my my farming grandparents, where 12 p.m. is high noon, and it balances the morning and evening light fairly for everyone. Morning light is especially important for school children, commuters, people who work outdoors, our service personnel. They need that morning light to wake up and feel alert and to perform well. This opinion is shared by the Minnesota Star Tribune, the Minnesota-based American Academy of Neurology, and 100 more nonprofits. Excuse me. It's supported by scientific polling. And I really appreciate this bill being brought forward, how it brings together both sides, people who want to have permanent daylight, permanent standard. Let's come together and just ditch the switch. This is the federally pre-approved way to do it. You can save lives and money very easily. Please vote yes on HF 1944. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody else from the public that wishes to testify? Once, twice? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either the author or maybe you. You'd mentioned relaying this over for possible inclusion.
Correct.
Possible inclusion into what? The OIG bill?
Representative Kosnick, that's a great question. I don't believe that there – we have not talked about whether or not there will be a policy bill. So – If the chair would, if the author would like, we can send it on to somewhere else. We could, if he would like.
I'll take that as a question. If you'd like to, we could move it to the general register or attempt to. We could.
We'll just lay it over. It's fine.
Okay.
Members, any other questions? Okay, we have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding is this would align us with the rest of the world so that there's not that oddity for travelers. Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Is closing remarks or?
I believe there was a question.
Oh, okay. I don't want to misspeak. Maybe I'd defer to one of the testifiers.
Dr. Pritchard.
There are still a few countries that do the daylight saving time, but many countries have switched to permanent standard time, including most recently Mexico.
Representative Quam. Nothing further? Okay. Well, as somebody who sleeps 2 hours a day, this doesn't matter to me anyway, so I'm up. It's great. Representative Freiberg, conclusion.
Yeah, thank you. I do appreciate you giving this bill a hearing. Like I said, it's something many people feel strongly about. It, you know, it's neglected to mention as bipartisan support. It's your average Freiberg, Niska, Zainab Mohammed, Eric Lucero bill.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, there's lots of those out there. So, yeah, I would hopefully this can move forward, and I appreciate your consideration.
Very good. With that, House File 1944 is laid over. Members, we are adjourned.